Deck number 16722, Captain George Ledger, reel 8.
Captain Ledger, reel 8. You were at Gondicore for a while, Captain Ledger, digging this ditch and doing what training you could. Did you get the opportunity to get some leisure in Lille or places like that?
Yes, the entertainment wasn't very much for us, apart from the local cafes and pubs. But I fully remember an occasion when the company was taken along to in trucks, we were taken along to the town of Lille, and we were entertained by Vera Lynn, who sang all the Force's favourite songs, and then we had about 2 hours entertainment by her there. That was the only time that we did have any entertainment before we went up into action in Brussels.
Are they emotional moments? You're away from home and your loved ones.
It's the first time I've ever seen a soldier with tears in his eyes. It was rather funny to say that, to answer your question. But when Vera Lynn got up and sang on that stage, and all the troops around there, there was quiet, you could hear a pin drop, and there was hundreds of troops in that big theatre, you could hear a pin drop, and if you had a look around, you would see tears in the eyes as she was singing. Especially these ones about coming home and such like, and being away, and especially this favourite one to sing, she sang called Yours. But to me, it's the first time I've ever had. I'm trying to look for the proper word of explaining it. The first feeling I've had of watching another soldier with tears in his eyes, just because the lady's up there singing about home. But I realise this happens now, of course. We've all left home, but Mike, as I was a single man, but a lot of the people who were with me, were married and had families behind and children. So you can understand the emotional feelings which were held up inside them when they were sitting listening to Vera Lynn sing these songs. It was rather sad occasion at times to watch that happening. But she was really applauded, and you could see everybody liked it, because the emotional... Vera Lynn dwelt on the emotions of people, you know, when she sang. Apart from entertainment, it was emotion, because she wanted applause all the time. Apart from doing the troops a good turn by entertainment, she wanted applause because it helped her her position as an entertainer in her future life throughout the war, you know, as it went on. Not that she did it deliberately to get applause, but the manner in which she sang was such that nobody could not be affected by it. They could not feel being affected emotionally by it. Myself, I was really affected, but I never shed any tears about it, because I wasn't, at that time, a family man as such, you know.
Some of them men, of course, had been away, or you'd all been away for some time now from families. Yeah. Were some men, or did you see yourself, experience any men who were having problems with the families at home, lack of mail, or...
Well, this happened. There used to be a breakdown of deliverance of mail, and on other occasions it wasn't the fault of the delivery service. It was the fault there would be some little upset at home, or a hiccup at home, which prevented the family from writing to the husbands or the families, and I just couldn't.
As a sergeant, did you have to deal with anyone in your own platoon that was having a problem like this?
No, I kept away from that sort of thing. I used to hand these emotional offers over to my officer, because that was a matter which I thought should be dealt with an officer. It's rather private business in people's private families, and not down to two sergeants, the sergeant talking about the private's private matter. I thought that's the way personally I felt. Whether I was right or wrong, I don't know, but I felt myself it wasn't the sergeant's job to take sides under that man, or to know or pass any information about that man's private household difficulties. I think it should be, I always thought that was the officer's point of view which had to be taken, and he was the one to help to sort the man out.
Did it affect the man's efficiency as a soldier to have problems on his mind?
It did, yes. When he wasn't getting any mail, you could find a man getting depressed. It was easy enough to get depressed with the state of the... with the feeling you were... the way you were living during the war. The stress in your heart and the feelings of uncertainty. But... I see when the mail van or clerk used to come round with the letters, the expectancy on people's faces, waiting for a letter, and none to be there, and they'll turn around and the faces would be deadpan, and you just feel as if you could pat them, you know, well, might come tomorrow, so that's that attitude. Yes, this happened, and... it was a natural thing for people to do, to be disappointed. I mean, that's natural living, what human beings do. You have to be disappointed if you don't get all your own way, I should say.
Can you recall when the German invasion of Belgium and Holland started?
Well, Belgium, I can recall Belgium when that was invaded, because we were quickly moved up from the anti-tank places where we moved, dug the anti-tank ditch. We were quickly moved up into Brussels, and from Brussels we were built it in a very, very old chateau. The whole regiment of us was there, the whole battalion was in this very, very big chateau, and one day there was the second command of the battalion, Ross McLaren, Major McLaren. He came and got a representative from each company to go forward up through Brussels and go forward past Brussels up to the forward lines where the second battalion of their infantry had been taken part in the defence, and they had been driven back. And they were coming, the Germans were coming through their lines. We had to go up and try and stem it. And the three of us, the section commanders went up with Major McLaren to stake out the land for our company sections. And he took us up there, and he dropped me off at one area, and he says that from there... 1-2 miles along there is your area for your company, your headquarters, and your three platoons, and your storekeepers, and just like. And he went away to do the same with another. After I'd been there about 3/4 of an hour, he came dashing back with his truck, and he got a hold of me, and by the arm, forcibly, quick, lad, you'd get under the truck. So I looked at him, because I had taken all my kit, my valise and everything, and put them upstairs in the farmhouse so that I could just have my rifle and my gas mask on so I can work putting the stakes in to stake out the various sections and platoon areas. So all my equipment I had in the world was up there in that farmhouse. And here was Major McLaren coming to me, tugging at my arm and throwing me on, or helping to get me up into that truck, which he did. And I says, all my equipment's up there, and he just ignored and get in that truck. And as we got in the truck and we turned around, 300 yards in front of us, the Germans there. And then they started firing. That was the first time that I ever experienced any enemy firing at me or the unit, you know.
What was your immediate reaction?
Horror. and just disbelief, because to suddenly come across a germ, you've been trained for all this, and you realise it's just there, you know. It's nothing glamorous, it's just something hideous. And you want to get on the ground, get out the road of it, you want to crawl down there. But I was up on the truck when all these bullets started firing, you know, the Germans there, the tanks. They were coming rolling down towards us, and there it was. And I just happened to get out, and my equipment's up there, and I didn't get the words fully out, and he says, get in there. So to this day, my equipment is still lying in that farmhouse. All my equipment I was issued with, and presents which I'd bought for the wife and for the family from the shops, I expect to go and leave shortly, you know. And I had to be re-equipped with everything when I got back to the regiment.
Can I just, before we go farther, ask about, you say, staking out section and platoon positions.
Yes, uh-huh.
When you put a stake in, between stakes is one position, do you mark your stake so
yes,
that people know who...
Yes.
And that was your responsibility?
That's my responsibility. They were just ordinary wood stakes. You had little crosses on each wood stake like this. And I just had a normal mallet and these wood stakes just... In fact, they were dropped off the truck, a certain quantity. That's your lot, Ledger, and the way you went. That's your area.
Have you been discussed with your own officer where the sections of platoons would go?
Oh, yes. All right.
In the context of the ground?
Before I went up there. This was discussed by Major McLaren with the company commanders. And it was part of to us, so we had to go up and... And then it was the area, the idea of which way the company commander wanted them was discussed with us briefly, because I hadn't much time to discuss it, because things were happening very, very quick. And they just roughly, in my case, they just sat down a little bit, just as I'm talking, you know, and just put the company headquarters there and there and there, there and the quartermaster stores across there. It was as haphazard as that when the time came. Nothing spectacular about organisation. It was that haphazard. But the information was there. And it was down to the likes of myself who was there planning it, staking it out, to put right any little things which weren't quite correct, you know, which I knew where the section had to be. And I knew a company headquarters had to be so far away from there. So we knew when our position started that we knew what to do, you know.
When you moved off into Belgium, when you set off to go into Belgium, you'd be going through towns and villages. How were the Belgians receiving you as you went through?
They didn't speak at all. There was no waving at all. When I went into Belgium, first of all, and I got off and we went into this big chateau. This was before we went up to meet it, before the attack came through the Durhams. We met one or two Belgians in the town itself. And there was one poor man there, and he was crying. And it was all the upheaval and all the refugees. The place was packed, because all the refugees have come there through there now. And he wasn't leaving his house because he didn't want to leave his daughter. And he turned around and said to all of us, if I leave my daughter here, she'll be raped by the Germans when they come. That's his words. I always remember him saying that. And he just stayed there and he just stood crying as we went. And he was still there. I remember fully when we actually left, he was standing there at his doorway with his daughter. And she would be about 16, his daughter, 15 or 16. And he was standing there, and he came away and just waved along. Not a lot of people took any notice of the British troops because they were too occupied and saving their own skins. They were trying to get away and getting their belongings and just like passing up.
As you moved up into Belgium, your own spirits, did you feel, right, we're going to get at them now?
Well,
what were you thinking?
Well, this was beginning to build up on us all. We started to all get that feeling. When we got that far, after having dug, we got really browned off with digging the anti-tank because it was hard. In my case, I was just offering instructions. I wasn't actually doing the digging, the manual piece. I was doing the organisation. But the lads were getting browned off, you know, digging, digging, miners, you know, and the digging thing. And the spirit seemed to get very heightened when they realised that at last they were going to do something. And it was amazing how, you know, they weren't saying, oh, I wish I was away back in the mine or digging. Oh, no. As you say, they were saying, well, the sharper the better. Let's get there and get back. Let's get there and get it done. That's, without contradiction of anybody, that was the feeling at that time.
Do you recall the name of the area, the places that you were in at this time up on the front?
Not on that time. Not all I know it was. It was because we advanced outside Brussels forward to meet the Durham, the second Durhams who had been driven back and who were coming through our lines. And that's all I don't. That's all the instructions we were given. We didn't know names. We didn't have a map to look at or where we're going there.
What happened to you next after the incident of the being pulled onto the lorry and brought away? Was this the beginning of your retreat?
This was when we came back. From there, we start to move to towards Vimy Ridge.
And the roads that you were coming back through Belgium, you say, were filled with refugees.
You could hardly move.
What was your own feelings? What were you seeing?
We saw a mass exodus of people who didn't know where they were going, just going somewhere. Didn't know where they were going to end up at. Because eventually, myself, I found out that they just couldn't get anywhere. When I eventually, after the... And we ended up at Dunkirk Beaches. We knew all these people. Then I realised all these people we've seen before, and they were going somewhere where they couldn't get to, because there wasn't room or place for them. But all these streets were littered and absolutely crowded with civilians pushing the goods and such like, just to get away from the advancing Germans.
How were you able to get through them?
With difficulty. Many times we had to go off the roads, not the grass verges, but in Brussels itself it was rather difficult, because there's no grass verges in the town itself. They were all roads and footpaths, and every one of them was piled, and you just had to do the best you could and get, you know, there was various people allotted for to try and direct one lot of refugees to one side to let the vehicles come through, and this happened to a certain amount of success. They could travel a certain way, then it would be stopped again by the refugees. And this is what we had to cope with. We had to get them moved out to one side and let so many trucks get through, you know.
It must have been a very disturbing sight to you.
It was a horrifying sight. It was. I think the majority of us were near to tears at times. I mean, we were just human beings. And we're just ordinary working people. And we hadn't been brought up to war, you know, we'd just been territorials. And we didn't, this was, oh, it was terrible what these people were suffering. We never realised that human beings could suffer as much as what these refugees were. And I remember to this day, I followed you, still there, that Belgian chap saying he's staying at home, and he's still there yet to this day. Well, he loved me, but he's still there. Remember, he's still there with his daughter, 15 or 16 year old, which he wouldn't leave because he thought she'd be raped by the Germans.
Did you experience any air attacks from the Germans during the retreat?
The whole time we were retreating, we were strafed by the German Air Force, and it was frightening. There seemed to be massive, large machines, because they were only coming about 30 feet above the ground. You could lift your rifle. You had the feeling that you'd lift your rifle and touch the belly of the aeroplane. It was that low. And, well, people just scrambled to one side and went into the ditches when they were outside the cities. Especially in France, it was just into the ditches, into the fields. And it was horrific to see some of the situation some of the families were in. I picked a girl, a little baby, up, and I carried a little baby myself. I carried her 5 miles. She was left lying in a ditch, a little baby girl, and I carried her 5 miles before I handed it across to a policeman, a French policeman, so that I'd get on with work. And I was in a troop movement.
Had her parents been killed or lost?
Just missing. She was just by herself. You know, she was, nobody wanted her. And it was a ditch, actually, where she was in. There was a pram there, a lot of good, hundreds and hundreds upon prams and barrows and wheat and such. And household goods just littered. And this child was there, crying. So when I was walking, we're marching along. We were struggling along past the groups. And I picked her up and I carried this kiddie 5 miles. And I handed it across to a French policeman when I got up to where I was going.
Did you see any civilians that had been hit?
Actually wounded.
Yeah.
Just lying in the... When we were advancing through France itself, not Belgium, but through France itself, they were littered up each side of the road in the ditches where they'd gone. Because when the planes came in France, it's low-lying country, you know, northern France, all the flat line. And the planes, you see far away, and they were just coming. You thought it was a pushchair, just as about high as a pushchair up off the ground, but massive aeroplanes, you know. And they seemed to be three times as big when they eventually came up, because they were that low. And you could see the bullets just spattering away on each side, and the dust kicking up as they were coming towards you, you know. Horrifying.
Did you fire on them yourselves?
No, I never did, no. We had strict instructions. We hadn't to waste our time. We had to get out the road naturally, and self-preservation was the main thing. And standing up with a rifle and trying to hit one of them things was just a waste of time.
How did you feel when you saw what they were doing to the civilians through these attacks?
Well, just horrified, that's all.
Towards the Germans?
I was just a young lad, 19-year-old.
Was there anger towards the Germans?
Terrific. I mean, we felt we didn't understand. Like one human being to another. I know now I can talk with hindsight, but I don't want to put it in that term. We are talking about the position as it was there, and I've got to put it in that position. I don't want to talk as if I'm talking in hindsight. But at that time, I just felt horrified and bewildered, not knowing that this sort of thing could happen. Just couldn't.
How did the civilians themselves take to you? I mean, everyone's retreating, you're pulling away from them, the Germans are behind them. Did they show any animosity towards you?
They didn't have time to show any animosity. They were too concerned about their own preservation. All I saw, and all they saw of us, we trying to get past them, and there was these horrible, really terrifying picture. These families with babies in their arms, pushing all the goods, and the heads down like this, pushing away, and the planes coming, strapping. It was horrifying.
Had yourselves feelings of failing them, not being there to stop the Germans?
We didn't have that feeling that we couldn't help them, because it was absolutely ridiculous to think that way. There's no man on earth could make any effort. One man just couldn't make any difference. Even a battalion of us couldn't make any difference, because it was the way the land, the roads were cluttered up, was amazing. You just couldn't describe it. You couldn't describe some of the ways in which we had to get off the roads into the fields and get back around some to get back onto the road to try and advance. And we were held up and held up and held up, and it was very, very upsetting.
You'd spend several days on that march from where you were in Belgium and right down through to Vimy, as you say.
Yes.
Where were you stopping at nights?
Just out on the banks of the rivers And we always had the position because we were fighting a sort of rear guard action from Brussels back on our way to Vimy Ridge, a rear guard action from Brussels around to go up to Vimy Ridge, but to meet the Germans at that side when we were going to make the attack on Arras. And
It was a long march.
It took days and days. And we used to just stop at nights, and we had our little entrenching tool. And we used to just dig a little little hollow for us to get in. Mainly it was by river sides and by the sides of bridges where you'd get across. If you had to escape quickly, the best place was to go somewhere near a bridge where you can dash across and get to the other side of the water, or vice versa.
You didn't get into any buildings for the night?
I can't remember ever going in any buildings from leaving Brussels to coming up before going up to Vimy Ridge, where we assembled at Vimy Ridge at 4 o'clock in this morning to start the attack on Arras.
After digging a ditch in France for quite a number of weeks and not getting that much training, and then that was mobile training, it must have played havoc with your feet, having to march all that way back.
Well, I think we all got used with the conditions. Our feet, I can't remember very many people at all that really went away to hospital had feet treatment. I had bad feet. In comparison with a lot of people. I've always had bad feet, but it didn't get me upset. Mind we had to suffer with it. The conditions were atrocious at times, you know, the work and the wet conditions. It wasn't all sunny, you know, it wasn't sunny Spain we were going to. It was terrific snow-covered France and foot deep of
The march back
clothes.
In May, June, what was the weather like on the actual march itself coming back?
Coming back from?
From the Belgium to?
Or into
what was the
Vimy
weather?
Ridge.
Was it hot?
No, not hot, but it was quite, actually, how would you describe this weather? It quite like the summit of this, I would say 50, 60 degrees approximately. More or less cloudy and showery like this.
Did you find it exhausting though over the days?
Oh, very, very exhausting. Because in our case, as infantrymen, we're having to fight a reserve, a withdrawal. The question of food just wasn't regular, you know. We were just getting bits and pieces at a time and what could be passed on and handed over. And the Quartermaster Sergeant had a terrific job trying to get grub to all of us, you know, because he was split out all over. And they couldn't always get the trucks up to where the units were for to give them the food if he had got it cooked. And many a time he would come up and say, well, I've had that cooked for about 2 or 3 days. And so, which is aggravating, like, and we have to have cold stuff, but.
Under these difficulties, did march discipline, was it retained?
Never had any problems. I never heard of anybody who was having court-martialed over any dissensions or anything like that. It wasn't a case of, we never marched properly as such. We marched, but we walked. It's rather funny to say we marched, but we walked. The marching business didn't apply when you got into those conditions. You just had to get from one point to another as quickly as you could with all your equipment. So it wasn't as if you were marching with a band in front of you, beating out the time.
Was there a temptation to loot for food if there wasn't very much to have?
Well, it did happen on 2 or 3 occasions, to my knowledge. When they were distributing from a quartermaster sergeant's truck, and you had people who were taking it off and handing it around, and once or twice, there was 2 or 3 occasions rather, where they were used to hand it across, and that would come across there and slip some. And then when they were finished, all that used to be taken away and put into ice. But yes, two or three occasions, there was cases of punishment for it.
Looting was frowned upon?
Well, it was frowned upon, of course. I mean, you were just taking the bread out of your mate's mouth, weren't you? and every one of us thought it was terrible for this to happen.